Nowadays, information technology is an essential part of any nation-state's toolkit. And yet, in the digital space, nation-states are just a few of many actors. A mastery of cyber operations can give nation-states the advantage they need to pursue their economic, national security, or foreign policy goals. But without the private sector and the civil society cooperation, that mastery can be difficult to achieve. Hosted by the Atlantic Council's Cyber Statecraft Initiative, Digital Statecraft, Digital Streetcraft features diverse perspectives from thinkers in academia, industry, and government. By bridging the worlds of statecraft and streetcraft, it examines questions at the nexus of information and communications technologies, geopolitics, and national security, searching for cooperation to make cyberspace safer, more stable, and more secure for all.
Hello, I'm Trey Herr, Director of the Cyber Statecraft Initiative at the Atlantic Council Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security, and host of this episode, Securing the Software Supply Chain. Our discussion today is sponsored by Raytheon, and my guest today is Michael Daly, CTO of Cybersecurity and Special Missions for Raytheon Intelligence Information and Services. Michael is a Principal Engineering Fellow providing leadership in Raytheon Cyber Technologies. He supports the National Security Telecommunications Advisory Committee to the President and holds a Bachelor of Science in Engineering from Boston University. Michael, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us today. So maybe to start off the conversation, you could tell us, what is a supply chain? What are we talking about here?
Well, a supplier is, of course, someone who provides you with something, pencils or paper. The supply chain is that set of suppliers to that supplier as well and down the line. So it might be the folks who cut down the trees and own the land and the forest, and then there's someone else who's getting the graphite together and selling that to the pencil company, and then there's a company that makes the machine that, you know, makes it pencil shaped, and somebody else is making paint, and so on and so forth. And so that whole array of companies that are making the bits and pieces that make up the pencil, that whole thing is all your supply chain.
When we think about a supply chain for software, what are we talking about? What makes this different from the pencil example?
With software, rather than, you know, the traditional thing, like a thing of a pencil where it's a fixed element that's complete, here it is, we're done. With software, you have to establish a longer-term relationship. There needs to be an idea that there's going to be ongoing maintenance, and it's going to keep it current and functional as the world changes around it and new vulnerabilities are learned about, or that this software to continue to be useful needs to integrate with other things. So if you think about your Apple Watch or something, right, there's software in there. You expect that it's going to evolve and stay current as the rest of the world evolves. When you buy an automobile and it has mapping software in it, you expect that that map is going to stay updated. And so it's different in that regard. It's different in many other ways as well, in that it can really be sourced not just from the standard kind of company you might imagine, but this concept of open source, where people all over the world who in their spare time at night have decided to write something and contribute code and make it available for the rest of the world. And you don't know who that person is necessarily. They might have a name written up there, but it might not even be their real name. They've just contributed code. And further complexity is that that code then lives on and gets copied by someone else and copied by someone else. And so there are remnants, fragments of code that may not even be attributed to the original author, because not everyone does that thoroughly. And so there's almost like a web of software that's rising up, and there's a lot of it. And maybe that's the other part of it that's complex about software. It's not hundreds of lines of code or even thousands of lines of code. Even in some of the most trivial things, the thermostat on your wall, it's millions upon millions of lines of code with many, many people all over the world over many years who have written things. And now when we talk about supply chain security for software, someone's going to come up with an attestation that says those millions of lines of code written by those thousands of people over many years, that's secure. Don't worry about it. It's all good.
Interesting. So I've got a tremendous number of moving parts. This is this expanded in complexity, thinking about software. I'm thinking about its whole life cycle. I can't just deliver the pencil, drop it off, and not think about it again. How do these defining characteristics of the software supply chain make securing software more or less challenging than the traditional hardware supply chain?
None of it is easy, for sure. Even in the physical world, that pencil manufacturer could have been infiltrated and somebody installed a bug in that pencil. And so now, it's going to spy on you and listen, right? And you would think it's just a dumb pencil, but nope, hidden inside the wood of the pencil is actually a radio, right? And in order for you to find that out, you would have to x-ray it or go and visit the factory where they're making it and do spot inspections. And so it's not easy in the physical world. In the software world, the chain is often, not always, but often even deeper, where it's, party A passes something to B, to C, to D, and trying to trace that provenance all the way back is very difficult. And the large number of lines of code, that millions and millions of lines of code, is very difficult for us to review to make sure there aren't additional features and functions, unwanted capabilities. With a pencil, you can do a pretty straightforward regression test. It should write, the eraser, should stay put, and I should be able to erase it. And, that's sort of it. Even a complex physical device can be a little bit easier to test sometimes. With software, finding those hidden features and functions is very, very difficult. We can embed code in a program that's only activated under some very strange circumstances that the adversary knows about and only they know about. And so it's complex because of the volume of it.
So you mentioned this possibility of manipulating software as something an attacker might do. What's another way, or what are some other ways that attackers try to target the software supply chain?
There are ways to modify the software itself by adding features after it's shipped out of the factory. One way that you might relate to more readily is if you visit a web page, right, that's software, and your browser software is interacting with that and the code comes down. And many of us have gone and visited a website and then clicked and then you get malware delivered. And what that points to is the dynamic nature of software. It's not a hard physical and it's done thing, but actually it can be modified on the fly specifically for you, right? You have cookies or whatever that tell the other people who you are, where you're coming from, what language you speak. All of that is provided. And then software can be generated on the fly specifically for you and delivered to you. So it becomes a very complex problem.
So there's a number of different ways for attackers to get into that process, it sounds like.
Many, many ways. there are frameworks that we've developed. There's one available to review on an organization called MITRE, worked on one in partnership with industry and the government, and we call it the ATT&CK framework, and it lists out many of the categories of ways that attacks can happen. There are other ATT&CK frameworks as well. I don't mean to point out just one, but that's a pretty good comprehensive one, but it lists the classes of attacks, and then it goes further and allows us to map actual specific adversary groups, known threat actors in the world who do bad things, and these are the techniques that they are really fond of. They tend to use these techniques because that's what they know. It doesn't mean they can't use other ones, but we've seen them use these techniques, so you might want to go watch for them.
Interesting. So the Encyclopedia Cyber, to some extent, it sounds like.
Right.
So if I'm somebody writing code, maybe I'm a vendor who's selling this code to a customer, how do I guarantee that the code that I've built is being delivered to the customer, that what I wrote is actually the same thing that they're receiving? How do I secure that part of the chain?
What we use are cryptographic methods, and basically just means math, and we take the original source code, which looks like English language or whatever language, French, but it's words, and then perform a math function on those words and come out with a number. So now what I can do is compare that number when it's received on the other end, when somebody performs that same math function on all of that code, and the two numbers should match at the end. We call that a hash value. That's one mechanism. It's the most common mechanism.
And can I use that same technology to verify that the code I'm now running on my computer is the same thing as what someone else had said it was, the vendor?
Right. Yeah, that's right. And it's those hash values that we use to do that. And you can go a step further and actually verify that it's not just the code, but that someone else, you know, someone specific is going to stand behind it. So a company like a Microsoft or Amazon or someone else could actually sign that code. So they'll take the hash and then use their keys, their encryption keys, to encrypt the hash. And that allows you to then say, oh, all right, let me use their public key to decrypt it. And only their public key should be able to decrypt it. Now I can see the hash. And that allows me to then do some comparisons.
So I wake up in the morning, I boot up my computer, and it's because of this process, it's only running code that's been signed by, say, Microsoft as an example.
Exactly right.
Interesting.
Yep. Okay. Yep. Now, so then that allows them to take a step back and not have to publish this gigantic list of hashes on a moment-by-moment basis of, you know, here's all the legitimate software that may be running on your system. Instead, they can cluster it as a family and say, any of these things that we've signed, they're cool.
They're okay. If I'm an attacker, so flipping the script on this a little bit, how would I try to get inside of that process? How would I try to take advantage of this trust that I'm assigning to this code that's been signed by a company like Microsoft?
Yeah, one of the techniques, and there are plenty, is that people will go and generate a certificate that says Microsoft in it and sign it. And it'll cause the machine to pop up and say, hey, you know, this doesn't seem legitimate, but it's signed by Microsoft. And many users will say, oh, well, all right, Microsoft, I expect to get software from them. That's okay. And they click accept and they run the install. And, you know, with Microsoft, you might be more hesitant because you'd think, oh, well, a Microsoft operating system, you know, they should at least know that that's good code. So maybe that one you wouldn't click on. But you might click on it if it had another name that you're not as familiar with. You know, on a Microsoft desktop, if you received that Amazon signed file, you'd say, oh, well, it's Amazon, you know, so click. Yeah.
Interesting. So there's ways to actually manipulate that trust process to take advantage of the user says, okay, I'm going to expect this thing to look like X. It looks like X, but it's actually an attacker instead of a vendor.
Right. And you even see other kinds of drive-by attacks like that on web pages, right? Many times you'll visit a website and a big pop-up comes up and it says, this is a message from, you know, Microsoft or Apple. And it, you know, looks legitimate because they know what a legitimate screen would look like. And they just copy it and they make it look like that. And so I'm sure you've received those calls from your mom or dad saying, should I click on it? Right? And you're like, if you're asking me, no.
Do not. You thought to call me.
Right.
This is interesting. So then if let's take it back the other direction. Let's say that I'm a vendor. I'm pushing this software out there, and I have users who are relying on that code being signed to execute it securely. What can I do to defend against these kinds of attacks where somebody might be trying to, you know, sign their malicious code with my authentic keys?
Yeah, the most common mechanism is doing what we call whitelisting. And there are software vendors who are out there to help you do that, so you can do it on an enterprise scale. But the idea is essentially only install known good software that you have validated with the manufacturer. You've only purchased software from authorized channels. You're not downloading it from another site on the web. You know, if you've ever downloaded software from the web, then you'll often see, even if you do a search for it, some of the first few hits are not from the manufacturer, but someone else who's saying, oh, you can download it from us. So if you download it from there, you're more than likely getting additional features and functions that are unwanted.
As we sit here today, we think about supply chain. It's been in the news in a really tremendous way over the last 18 months. What's driving this recent flurry of attention as compared to 5 or even 10 years ago? Certainly, supply chain's been around a long time.
A few things. One, the complexity of the supply chain has grown. As you know, most companies now outsource huge elements of their enterprise. They focus on their core. On top of it, the speed of business, right? The launch of new companies, startups, is enabled by that stack of business services that you can now acquire through, you know, online capability, right? Your Salesforce.com and all of that stuff, things that you used to have to hire people in to manage for you. Nope, we can take care of all of it. So that has helped expand the depth and the breadth of the supply chain that many companies use. Even your laundromat, if you walk up to them, they used to have a cash register. It was mechanical and the money went in and out. And now, you know, it's an online system that they're using to take your payment. Even the tiniest store is tied into a cloud-based service. So the complexity of that supply chain has grown. And then we've seen an increasing number of breaches, and that has led us to then want to assign blame. We want to know who is responsible for this crime that has occurred. You know, I've lost my personal information, somebody's stolen my money, bad things have happened. I need someone to blame. And we need that not just emotionally, but legitimately, financially, legally. We have to hold people accountable. And so that's what's driven supply chain security measures and software supply chain, is to affix in law and in practice some measure of, well, you're 10% responsible and you're 90% responsible. And
that responsibility question is interesting. It speaks to the complexity of the ecosystem you were talking about earlier with respect to software. Where do you think we should be assigning more or less responsibility for the security of the software supply chain?
I don't know that I have a hard opinion on it yet. I think it's still evolving in my own brain. I go back and forth. So, you know, in the biggest sense, you know, I'm buying a product from company X, then I really don't want to have to deal with their back-end supply chain. You know, that was your decision. You chose this company over that company, all the other one. So I think, you know, my real answer is that I want to hold accountable the company from whom I acquired it. At the same time, if they are running a desktop operating system from one of the vendors and they get compromised through a, you know, something that was really not their fault, then it's a little difficult for me ethically to think that I need to hold them fully accountable for that, unless they just didn't do all the basic things. If they didn't patch it, they weren't monitoring, they weren't doing any of the fundamentals. The trouble I'm having in answering your question is the reason why we do not yet have broad adoption of cyber insurance, because the cyber insurance companies also struggle with figuring out, well, how much of the best practices did you actually employ? So how much responsibility are we going to assume as your insurer in paying off the problems that you've had? And, you know, that problem is what has slowed down adoption of insurance.
Interesting. So a difficulty in really assigning the source of risk, even if we can all agree on what the risk is.
Mm-hmm.
Intriguing. So if we're thinking about the security of the software supply chain over the next 5 years, again, that really complex ecosystem where you've got lots of different players writing code and pushing it out. Mm. What do you see as the biggest trend, or and either positive or negative, that we're going to encounter over the next 4 to 5 years?
Well, I don't know if it's the biggest. It's one that popped into my head, and that's the continued rise of managed security services, where similar to insurance, there's going to be this desire to move risk out of your enterprise. You can't fully remove it, but you can reduce some of that and say, well, there's no way that I could possibly be the full cybersecurity expert and everything. I'm going to hire people who are experts. And so even if you're a company that's writing some software, not just integrating other people's software, if you're writing software, still there's going to be this rise in third-party managed security testing, validating, continuous verification. I think that's what we'll see. It's really just a rise of professionalism, right? You go to a specific doctor for a specific purpose. You know, you don't go to a toe doctor for a problem with your ear.
So I'm trying to concentrate that security responsibility into the most specialized or the most competent pools of talent.
Yeah, correct.
And those clusters of talent, though, then themselves potentially become targets, don't they?
Oh, for sure they do.
So a lot of excitement in this space to come.
Most certainly.
That's excellent. Yeah. Well, Michael, we appreciate you spending some time with us today. This is an interesting topic and certainly one where there's a lot to know and a lot to learn, it sounds like, in the near future. So thanks for spending a little bit with us.
I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to Securing the Software Supply Chain, this episode of the Digital Statecraft, Digital Streetcraft podcast from the Atlantic Council Cyber Statecraft Initiative. If you enjoy this podcast, please find more from our new website at atlanticcouncil.org, or look for our hashtag on Twitter, AC Cyber.